walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
All right. Good morning. This is Talking Animals. That was our new Talking Animals theme by the fabulous Rebecca Pulley. As part of the expanded lineup of this weekend's Tropical Heatwave, Rebecca Pulley and the Reluctant Prophets perform this Friday night at the Cuban Club Cantina at 8:40. More information at WMNF.org. My guest today is Paul Shapiro, Vice President of Farm Animal Protection at the Humane Society of the United States. And in that capacity, has spearheaded numerous legislative campaigns to improve the plight of farm animals. We'll speak with Paul presently. Also, later in the show, we'll have a brief chat with Glenn Hatchell, whom we perhaps know best as the host of the Thursday morning show here, but we'll be talking about the dog playgroups he directs at the Humane Society of Tampa Bay. Right now, though, with a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing us at dj@wmnf.org. Let's welcome Paul Shapiro to Talking Animals. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Duncan. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks so much for joining us on Talking Animals.
Thanks for having me.
So, Paul, I've heard you speak on panels. I've met you briefly. You're a young guy, yet you've been advocating for farm animals, better laws, veg eating for more than 20 years, which raises at least two questions. One, did you start when you were a toddler? And what were the very beginnings of your doing this sort of work? What triggered your interest, and what else were you doing at the time?
That's kind of you, Duncan. So I'm actually in my 50s, and it's just through a plant-based diet that keeps me looking this young. No, just kidding, just kidding. I got interested in animals really as a child, but when I was growing up, I considered myself an animal lover, meaning I loved dogs. I loved the dogs who were part of our family. These were my brothers and my sisters. I loved them so much. In fact, I think I loved them more than some of the biological members of my family at times during my youth. But when I turned 13, I really had some events that took place in my life that changed me in very substantial ways. And probably the most seminal one of them was when a friend of mine showed me a video of what happens to animals in the fur industry, in the circus industry, in the factory farming and slaughter plant industry. And I was so horrified. I could not believe that we would commit that type of violence against animals. I saw my own dogs in these animals who were locked up in cages, who were being slaughtered, who were being beaten. And I thought to myself, I would do anything to prevent my dogs from enduring that type of torment. So why should I be willing to inflict that type of suffering on any animal, whether they be a dog or a cat or a pig or a chicken? And so I started volunteering, started changing my own diet as well to try to make it more nonviolent. I started volunteering and interning for various animal groups. And when I started high school, I started a club at the time called Compassion Over Killing, that I later turned into more of a national organization, but at the time it was just a high school club. And that's really how I got my start doing animal advocacy.
For sure. So talk a little bit more, if you will, Paul, about Compassion Over Killing. I mean, what, you know, beyond the high school group, what it became, as you allude to, and, you know, sort of what it does and what its mission is, really.
Compassion Over Killing was founded in 1995, really to try to give a voice to animals at first in this high school, but later it became a more national organization that I was fortunate enough to run until the very first month of 2005. And the organization became pretty well known for its hard-hitting campaigns on behalf of farm animals, conducting undercover investigations at egg factories, at chicken slaughter plants, at livestock auctions, and more. And the more exposés we did, the more national attention the suffering of farm animals was getting. Now, back then, these weren't issues that were really discussed that much, even in the animal protection community. There wasn't a big focus on the treatment of farm animals, despite the fact that farm animals represent more than 9 out of 10 of all of the animals who we institutionally exploit in this country every single year. But back then, there wasn't as much focus on them, and so what we did was really try to change the dialogue and create a dialogue, really, about the hideous and rampant abuse that we see in our nation's meat, egg, and dairy industries. We would also engage in litigation campaigns to try to prevent farm animal abusers from misleading consumers about their abuse, oftentimes putting humane washing claims on their product packaging and more.
And Paul, I mean, one of the reasons I want to take more than just a passing reference to compassion over killing is that, as you've kind of touched on here, you know, some of the roots of really important things that happened later in the animal welfare, especially when it comes to farm animals, efforts were really there, like the, video that was sort of that you guys would go in and sort of shoot undercover style was sort of a precursor to a lot of what we hear about in a minute or two. I definitely want to speak with you about ag gag laws and stuff. But I mean, that and then these so-called open rescues that Compassion Over Killing was known for. And like you said, some of the legislative efforts were, you know, sort of built on later with various organizations. Then, of course, your own efforts really throughout your career, sort of a through line really in your career.
Thanks, Duncan. You know, we did do a lot of what you were talking about, and these investigations were some of, not necessarily the absolute first, but some of the first exposés of factory farms and slaughter plants that really were precursors to the type of work that we're seeing now. And at the time, our means of distributing these videos was very limited. In fact, I still remember the first egg factory investigation that we did, which was in 2001, we videotaped horrific conditions. Birds locked up in cages so cramped they can't even spread their wings. Dead birds rotting in cages with their living cage mates still eating and sleeping and laying eggs for human consumption right on top of them. Birds entrapped in the wires of their cages, dying of dehydration, literally just inches away from water because they'd become completely immobilized. And these were all the types of things that were just standard. You would find them in any major egg factory that you would go into. And our means of distributing these videos were quite limited. I remember when we made that video, we produced 1,000 VHS tapes. You know, this was before, there was widespread videos online. And I remember thinking, God, how are we ever going to sell 1,000 of these tapes? And we did, and I couldn't believe it. I thought, we have gotten 1,000 people to watch this. It's really amazing. Now, when we at the Humane Society of the United States or Compassion Over Killing or Mercy for Animals does an undercover expose, it's not uncommon to have 500,000 or 1,000,000 views of it online within days.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think that's one of the reasons why you see the meat industry taking such offense at these exposés is because of the efficiency at which we can disseminate these videos showing the truth of what happens to farm animals in these days.
For sure. Well, I do want to come back and really kind of expand on sort of that and the whole ag gag laws sort of that both on the horizon. Some already are further along than that, obviously, unfortunately. But let me just let folks know, this is Talking Animals. If you just tuned in, my guest is Paul Shapiro, Vice President of Farm Animal Protection at the Humane Society of the United States. If you'd like to ask Paul a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663 or email dj@wmnf.org. So, Paul, how did the move then to the Humane Society of the U.S. Come about from Compassion Over Killing?
Well, Compassion Over Killing was and is a fantastic organization, and it was a real honor to be able to work there for so long. At the middle of 2004, the Humane Society of the United States, the largest animal protection group both in the country and the world, elected a new president, Wayne Pacelli, and he wanted to start a farm animal protection campaign at HSUS, which it really hadn't had for the most part before then. And so I and some of my coworkers from Compassion Over Killing filled that role to create and start this campaign for the Humane Society while still keeping Compassion Over Killing running and having many of the organization's best and longest-term volunteers running the group who are still running it today, more than 8 years later. So it's really a best-of-both-worlds scenario where HSUS, which is such a powerhouse as far as animal protection is concerned, can have a very good, hard-hitting, effective farm animal protection campaign, while at the same time, Compassion Over Killing continues doing the great work that it's always done.
Yeah, you know, over the years, it seems like it's been sort of a minor MO of HSUS to acquire animal welfare organizations and or acquire their leaders or key advocates. And just seems like, you know, that's a, you know, textbook example right there that you've decided. So Paul, maybe you could describe now your key responsibilities at HSUS, maybe framed as, you know, one or two of the more effective legislative campaigns that you've helped to orchestrate.
Sure. Thanks, Duncan. I do just want to briefly comment on your point about HSUS's mergers and acquisitions, and that animals need a very powerful voice. Animals aren't able to speak for themselves, and so what they need is a politically potent voice. Just like gun owners have the NRA, either love them or hate them, nobody disputes their power because they are such an effective lobby within Washington, D.C. Animals need a very powerful voice for them, too. And as far as political action for animals is concerned, HSUS is really the most effective organization that there is. As well, I mean, HSUS does many other wonderful things. It provides more direct care for animals than any other animal protection charity through HSUS's wildlife rehab centers, animal sanctuaries, spay-neuter services, and more. But I think that through the types of acquisitions that it has been able to accomplish, it's been a real win-win for animals and for all of the organizations that have been involved in these modifications. In terms of your second point, though, I think that probably what HSUS is most well known for is the California Proposition 2 campaign, which is a 2008 ballot measure that we waged throughout the Golden State to make that state, at the time, the fifth state to ban gestation crates for pigs, these tiny cages where pigs in the pork industry are unable even to turn around in for essentially their entire lives. To make it the third state to ban veal crates, where calves are kept immobilized similarly to those pigs. And then the first state at the time to ban the battery cage for egg-laying hens, these tiny confinement cages that we were discussing earlier in the show. And the animal agribusiness industry spent huge sums of money, $10 million, trying to combat Proposition 2, telling voters that they were going to get sick with salmonella because people would be eating eggs from birds who were kept with more space than what they have now, even running ads showing a little girl in the back of an ambulance going to the hospital because she got sick from eating eggs after Prop 2 had passed. Really misleading stuff, but in the end, Californians overwhelmingly, by a 2-to-1 margin, voted to pass Proposition 2, and that really changed the landscape. For years, the animal protection movement had been right about this factory farming debate, but now we're finding ourselves not just on the right side, we're finding ourselves on the winning side, and the tidal wave that was created by Prop 2's passage led to numerous other states enacting similar laws across the country, to the point where now we have 9 states banning various inhumane factory farming practices, and we hope that New Jersey will become the 10th later this month if Governor Christie will sign a bill that will soon be sent to his desk, we predict, that would ban gestation crates for breeding pigs.
Wow. So yeah, no, that's, I mean, really so important. I mean, anyone that's really listened to this show for any length of time knows that really a guiding, you know, principle here is that the best way really to protect our animal brethren really comes down to passing, you know, new laws to prevent exploitation, neglect, abuse, cruelty, whatever it might be, or in some cases, strengthening existing legislation. And it seems like when it comes to farm animals, that's particularly your bailiwick.
Right, absolutely. All animals deserve protection from abuse, whether they be dogs, cats, parrots, chickens, turkeys, pigs, you name them. If they're capable of suffering, they deserve our consideration and our protection. And the more vulnerable to abuse they are, the more protection they really need. And there are essentially no animals who are more vulnerable than the farm animals who we raise for meat eggs and dairy in this country. As I mentioned earlier, more than 9 out of 10 of all of the animals who we institutionally exploit in this country are farm animals. That is to say that if you were to take all of the animals used in every other animal use industry, whether it's the fur industry, the circus industry, animals used for experimentation, animals killed by hunters, and you add all of them up compared to the number of animals who are used for food, they aren't even 1 out of 10. That's not to suggest that we shouldn't be concerned about the treatment of dogs and cats and wildlife. Far from it. They need more protection, not less.
Mm-hmm.
But it is to say that if we're serious about wanting to fundamentally reduce the total universe of animal suffering that we're causing, we have to take farm animal protection more seriously than we as an animal protection community have taken it in the past. And I'm so heartened to see our movement making so many strides on behalf of farm animals now that farm animal protection is one of the most covered issues relating to animals in the mainstream news media today.
And Paul, again, that really comes back to the importance, really, of legislation. You know, the property thing that you explained. You know, a classic, fairly recent example. You know, so either way, it seems like it's all about legislation, and yet sometimes that process gets flipped on its side. To work, or at least attempted to work, against animal welfare. So maybe you could, we've alluded to it briefly here a couple times, but maybe you could talk a bit about the so-called ag gag laws that have popped up and been proposed in recent years, and you know, what they really sort of aim to do.
Sure. Recent exposés by groups like the Humane Society of the U.S. and Compassion Over Killing, Mercy for Animals, and others have repeatedly documented rampant animal cruelty in the meat, egg, and dairy industries. These exposés have not only led to major food buyers changing their policies and requiring animal welfare improvements in their supply chains, they've also led to new public policies. They've led to criminal convictions, they've led to congressional hearings, they've led to meat recalls, slaughter plant shutdowns, and more. And the meat industry's response to these exposés has not been to try to prevent the abuses from taking place. Rather, it's just been to try to prevent Americans from finding out about that abuse in the first place. What the meat industry is doing and is trying to do across the country is pass laws to not help blow the whistle on these abuses, but really to blow the whistle on the whistleblower. These ag gag laws have been passed in certain states that essentially make it a crime to conduct these undercover investigations. For example, in Utah, it's now illegal just to take a photo of somebody abusing an animal in a slaughter plant. In fact, just about a week or so ago, a woman was arrested in Utah for doing just that. She was standing on public property and pulled out her cell phone to videotape people moving down to cows too sick or injured even to stand and walk to their own slaughter, moving them around with chains on a tractor. And she was arrested.
Yeah.
Not the animal abusers, they weren't arrested, but the woman who pulled out herself on the video tape from a public sidewalk was the one who was arrested. In other states like Iowa and Missouri, they've enacted similar laws to try to crack down on the whistleblowing exposés. And in Tennessee right now, the legislature has passed a bill that's sitting on the governor's desk, waiting his either signature or veto, that would add Tennessee to the list of those states passing ag-gag legislation to suppress whistleblowers. It's a real travesty, but it just goes to show, you know, that you have a lot to hide when you want to make it a crime for somebody just to take a photo of what you're doing. And that is what the meat industry is trying to do.
And Paul, I mean, you know, if the situation weren't so grim, it would seem like something out of the Marx Brothers. I mean, it's just so kind of absurdist that, as you really eloquently explained here, I mean, these awful things are going on, not everywhere, but in many operations. So the idea, instead of correcting that or fixing those up, cleaning those up, it's like, hey, we're just going to make it illegal for you to bust us, expose us, record us, whatever it might be. And we've got some legislators who feel the same way we do. I mean, can you kind of sort of help us reconcile that a little bit? I mean, is that, like many things, just strictly come down to money, or how?
Yeah, it does. You know, imagine how strong the Farm Bureau, which is the biggest lobby for the ag industry, is in these states like Iowa or Utah or Tennessee, which have a lot of their economy based on agriculture. And their goal is to provide even more protection from any type of expose to these factory farmers and to slaughter plants. Keep in mind, this is a time when, keep in mind, this is a time when Americans want to know more about how their food is produced. We need more transparency in this industry, and they want to pull the curtains over this industry so that nobody can see what's happening, to have the abuses take place behind a veil of secrecy. And that is what's going to happen if these ag gag laws pass. Fortunately, no state in 2013 has passed any of these ag gag laws, but 11 states have tried, and Tennessee is the closest to passage, although we are very hopeful that Governor Bill Hasselbaugh will veto this bill. But remember that this is an industry that already has more protection than virtually any other industry in the country. If you take just as one example, the anti-cruelty goods in our country, which provide some level of protection for animals like dogs and cats, unfortunately, most state anti-cruelty goods exempt agricultural practices, regardless of how abusive they may be. So, for example, if you were to take your dog to the vet to have him neutered because you're concerned about pet overpopulation, and your vet neutered your dog without any painkiller, your vet could lose his or her license. They could be thrown in jail. You could sue them. They'd probably be charged with criminal cruelty. But if it wasn't a vet, if it was just an untrained farmhand and it wasn't a dog, but it was instead a pig or a calf, there would be no prosecution because unanesthetized castration is a common practice within agriculture, just cutting their genitals off with no pain relief whatsoever. That's how much protection this industry has, that routinely the meat industry inflicts cruelty on farm animals that they would be thrown in jail for doing the same exact thing to dogs or cats. And now they want even more protection so that Americans won't even find out about these abuses in the first place.
So, Paul, I'd like to think that what you said a moment or so ago about the public seeking more information these days about how their food is, you know, arrives really in front of them, and more transparency in that way. Is that enough overall? And is that partly at least why so far none of these laws have been passed in 2013? Even if it's just on this level, is it just too sort of dicey for certain politicians who might otherwise see some nice contributions or some other financial gain to supporting the ag-gag laws? Is it too dicey for them politically to say, hey, we're gonna push this ag-gag law thing through?
I think that the primary reasons that you haven't seen any of the bills get passed this year are a fewfold. The first is that, you know, it's difficult to pass a bill no matter what.
Yeah.
But second, the real First Amendment considerations associated with the ag-gag bills, regarding whether you can take photos or what you have to do with the photos once you've taken them. So the real First Amendment concerns. And then there's also the question, especially in states that perhaps aren't dominated by the agribusiness lobby, of how much protection this industry really deserves. I mean, it already has almost, you know, it has the ability to do nearly anything to animals that it wants. Should it also have the ability to prevent people even from knowing about what it's doing? And so I think that those type of arguments are winning the day, but these types of bills don't just die. They're killed. They don't die. Ag-gag bills are killed. And the way that they're killed is through tireless, dedicated animal welfare advocates, First Amendment advocates, public health and food safety advocates, all mobilizing and getting calls and emails into lawmakers, letting them know that they do not want these bills to be passed. And so, for example, in Tennessee right now, the governor's office asserts that it has never received more communications on any bill than it has on the ag-gag bill that is now on his desk, that they've been overwhelmed with calls and emails urging the governor to veto this bill. Native Tennessean Carrie Underwood has also urged the governor to veto this. Ellen DeGeneres did a show which she had HSUS CEO Wayne Pacelli on to talk about why Governor Haslam should veto this bill. So by having some sunshine on the process, it makes it much harder for these type of nefarious pieces of legislation to get through.
So, Paul, I want to move on in a moment just so we have time to cover some other things. But just to finish up on this, so because you had mentioned that Tennessee was sort of the closest to passing, but in light of what you just explained about avalanche of communications the governor has reached and Carrie Underwood and Ellen DeGeneres and Wayne's efforts, I mean, what's your gut on this?
I've learned, Duncan, it's really hard to make predictions, especially about the future.
So, sure, sure.
I feel optimistic that the governor will do the right thing. Keep in mind, the governor has only vetoed one bill ever in his gubernatorial history. So he doesn't have a big track record of issuing vetoes. But I do hope that the democratic process, where you have massive engagement from constituents within his state who are urging him to veto this bill, I do hope that he will listen to them and decide that doing the will of the Tennessee Farm Bureau is not as important as doing the will of the Tennessee people. And we'll know soon, because he has until Monday of this upcoming week to sign or veto it.
Yeah.
So we'll know in the near future. But I'm optimistic that democracy and reason will prevail here.
Sounds like the classic cautiously optimistic phrase.
Always.
Yeah. So this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Stress. My guest is Paul Shapiro, Vice President of Farm Animal Protection at the Humane Society of the United States. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing dj@wmnf.org. So let's get in at least one of our emailers at this point. This one says, hi, Duncan. Has your guest worked on raising awareness of chicken abuse at KFC, better known as Kentucky Fried Cruelty? I've heard some awful things about KFC debeaking their chickens and making them quote-unquote top-heavy with breast meat. I also don't like their new I Ate the Bones ad campaign with boneless chicken meat. It makes me think that they have bioengineered some boneless Franken chickens.
Well, thank you so much for the email. That's great of you. And you're obviously well-informed. KFC is a company that has a very sordid track record when it comes to animal cruelty. It's one of the biggest sellers of chicken in the country, and the chickens who we raise for meat in this country are bred to be top-heavy. We've bred them to grow so big, so fast, that many of them have difficulty taking even more than a few pitiful steps before collapsing underneath the weight of their bodies at the end of their very abbreviated six-week lives. The broiler, they call them broiler chickens, these are the chickens raised for meat, and the broiler breeders, tens of millions of these birds who are used for breeding purposes to bring in all of the billions upon billions of broiler chickens who we eat, they do have their parts of their beaks cut off, and they are also typically kept in a state, the breeders are, of kept in a state of chronic hunger. They're purposefully underfed as a way to try to prolong their breeding days. So these animals lead lives that are characterized by suffering. They grow so big, so fast, that they really are prisoners in their own bodies. They have been bred to suffer. In other words, no matter how they are housed, no matter what environment, they could be in a pasture, free-range environment, and they would still be suffering because their bodies are just so unfit and they have difficulty even walking for any real length of time.
Okay, well, thank you, emailer, for that question. And Paul, this kind of reminds me of something else I was going to maybe bring up. You know, we spoke earlier about HSUS absorbing smaller animal welfare organizations and or hiring, you know, sort of hotshot leaders and advocates like yourself. And this practice kind of may account for HSUS becoming, you know, fairly monolithic corporate entity, and therefore decisions get made in one wing maybe of the operation that may leave folks in another wing scratching their heads. And certainly on this show, I had some very direct exchanges with Wayne about the Michael Vick situation, certainly probably the most polarizing decision to come out of HSUS, at least in many years. So I want to ask you, with that in mind, about something I saw just a few days ago, HSUS recognizing Burger King with the National Animal Welfare Award. I mean, I guess there's gray area here, including Burger King's effort to, you know, in the confinement of farm animals in small crates and cages, and that in that way it probably represents progress. But I just know that, too, that for many this kind of award defies logic, and I just couldn't help notice a Facebook post earlier this week with that announcement, sort of linked to that announcement, with the poster just commenting simply, and this is why the Humane Society is a joke. So I'd like to hear your comments on that.
That poster wouldn't be the only person upset by that. The National Pork Producers Council has been very upset by what Burger King has been doing, and the National Pork Producers Council has been deriding Burger King for its work. Keep in mind, the award that we gave them is called, just as you said, Progress. called the Corporate Progress Award.
Mm-hmm.
Not an award saying that they are humane. It's not an award saying that they set some type of, you know, high-end standard as far as these issues are concerned. It's an award that recognizes the progress they've made. So when we think about a company like Burger King, which controls vast numbers of animals, and not them controlling them, but they're buying products from vast numbers of animals they can control in some ways how those animals are treated. This is a company that has told their egg producers they want to get rid of all cages for laying hens and go to 100% cage-free eggs. This is a company that's told its pork producers it wants no more gestation crates. It wants to get all of the pigs, all the breeding pigs out of these gestation crates. It's a company that's running ads promoting its veggie burger on TV. It's a company that's promoting Meatless Monday via its Facebook and Twitter accounts, which both have a huge following. So the progress that this company is making is important.
Yeah.
And when we look at these major companies, we want to recognize progress. We want to applaud progress while not necessarily demanding purity. I always think that it's a good idea to encourage people to take the first step rather than punish them for not taking the last step.
Yeah.
And they've made incremental progress. And so were the award called something else, I would feel differently. But the fact is, they are making substantial progress, and they're being derided by the meat industry for it. And so I think it's important for somebody, whether it be the Humane Society or somebody else, to recognize that progress that's being made.
So in a sense, I know this is clearly not what you're saying, but I'm sort of saying it, you know, summarizing in a way what you're saying relative to some of the outcry about this, is that this award essentially kind of is looking at the continuum and saying, okay, Burger King, you're less awful now than you were, so here's your national animal welfare award.
Well, it's called the Corporate Progress Award.
Right. It's a Henry Spear, yeah. I guess, is to be the full name, Humane Corporate Progress Award. It sounds like really, you know, what it's acknowledging is you know, a step or two along that continuum. As you kind of noted there, I mean, this world is so full of gray area and people that just really want it to be, you know, extreme in this direction, or it doesn't sort of count. So
yeah,
I guess,
you know what, you know, Duncan, I hear that very much. So I mean, look, I've been a vegan for 20 years now. So
yeah.
I would love to live in a world in which there was no violence against animals at all. I want to make it clear that we don't live in that world.
Yeah.
And we live in a world where progress often does beget progress, and food buyers can play a huge role in affecting how animals are treated. And when a company like Burger King starts promoting Meatless Monday and starts taking out ads for veggie burgers on TV, when a company like Burger King is telling its egg and pork producers that their standard industry practices are not sustainable and need to be changed if they want to continue doing business with them, that's real progress.
Yeah.
And this is the type of progress that wouldn't have occurred 10 or 15 years ago, but it is occurring now, and it's a sign of the animal protection movement's increasing influence.
All right. Well, there's so many things I want to get into that are sort of in that realm, but we've had some callers at least holding. Let's at least get one or two involved here. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Paul Shapiro.
Hello.
Hi, it's you. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Duncan. I just want to thank you so much and your guest speaker for paying attention to this critical issue. I think for many folks, ignorance is bliss. My name is Barbara Lepresti, and I spearheaded an effort to get new legislation on behalf of dogs, so it's a little bit of a off the subject, but I think it falls in line with what you're talking about, because it was a long 3-year battle just to get an anti-tethering ordinance passed in Hillsborough County. And my biggest surprise during that time was that the commissioners and the Animal Advisory Board of Hillsborough County brought in the representatives from USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, to speak out against any new legislation. And so I think we're unified in any efforts to help animal welfare. Also, I want to remind people in Hillsborough County, it was Jim Norman that was a strong proponent of this U.S. of this gag bill. And then I also wanted to thank, while you've got a representative from Humane Society speaking today, I want to thank the Humane Society for bringing light to some of the truth behind Nathan Winograd and his corruption. I think there are a lot of people out there that have not done their homework and do not realize some of the realities behind this man. So just want to thank you once again, Duncan, your speaker. You guys are wonderful.
Okay. Okay, Barbara, thanks for your call. Paul, I don't know if you want to respond to one or more of her points briefly. I know we're sort of at the end of our time here, but anything you want to...
Just briefly, Barbara, I want to say thank you. That's very kind of you. You're right that former state senator in Florida, State Senator Jim Norman, was a big proponent of these gag bills. Fortunately, his bill failed, and he's no longer serving. But this has now become a problem across the country, as we've been talking about, and we will continue fighting it. But thanks so much for your call, Barbara.
Okay, so, and let me just maybe take this moment to say that relative to the Nathan Winograd reference, I just want to say that next week on the show, my guest will be Ian Hallett, who's Hillsborough County Director of Animal Services, who's Be the Way Home Plan, a huge, ambitious gambit that includes 60 initiatives intended to reduce the county's euthanasia rate, including a pilot feral cat program was approved exactly a week ago this morning, in fact, by the Hillsborough Board of County Commissioners. So we'll discuss the plan, some of the relevant issues, Hallett's observations after nearly a year on the job, and more next Wednesday on Talking Animals. So we're just sort of almost out of time, but let's try to take one more. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Paul Shapiro.
Hi, are you speaking with me?
I sure am, and we just have maybe a minute or so. So if you have a quick question or comment for Paul.
Thank you very much. My name's Beth Robbins. I appreciate you taking my call. I have a question real quick. I'm curious why Nathan Winograd has attacked the Humane Society of the United States. Is it true that Richard Berman is a front man and Nathan Winograd has been put in his position to further that cause and help the farm industry?
I will just say,
thanks so much for your question. For listeners who may not be familiar, there's a gentleman by the name of Nathan Winograd who basically wages campaigns against a lot of animal organizations, whether they be HSUS or the ASPCA or PETA. There's a whole host of groups who he likes to campaign against. And he has done some work with a guy named Rick Berman. He did an interview for Rick Berman's website and was promoted by that website. And Rick Berman is a frontman for the meat industry. The animal agriculture industry pays Rick Berman to attack groups like the Humane Society and PETA and others on behalf of them to try to prevent any animal welfare reforms from being implemented. So, you know, there's a lot of folks who like to attack animal protection groups, whether they be HSUS or otherwise, and oftentimes they work together to wage these attacks. And the greatest sign of respect that I think we can have is that these folks like Rick Berman and the meat industry are so upset by what we're doing that they want to attack us. If they weren't attacking us, they wouldn't be concerned about our effectiveness. So we'd much rather be engaged here than to be ignored, because that would be the ultimate sign of ineffectiveness if we were just being ignored. So we take it as an occupational hazard. You know, you walk in the rain, you're probably going to get wet. And by waging campaigns for animals, we are walking in the rain every day. And these really are battles. They're battles with a multi-billion dollar industry that feels like it has a lot to lose with the status quo being challenged, the status quo being that it can pretty much do to animals whatever it wants. And we're challenging that, and we're winning. And we expect this to go back. In fact, we expect it'll get stronger in the years to come as we continue to make more and more advances on behalf of animals to protect them from cruelty.
Thank you for your caller, and thanks for your answer, Paul. And we're way out of time, but I got to just quickly, maybe this is a good place to note on which to end the chat here. So there's a quick email here that says, thank you so much to your guest for his brave and crucial work on behalf of animals. Progress, how many thanks to you. I saw a picture of you with a cat on your chest. Who is that cat? He, she looks very appreciative.
Well, thank you so much. That makes my day. That is one of my cats whose name is Emma, and she is the one of the loves of my life, and I'm definitely going to let her know that she's been made famous by this radio interview.
Well, yeah, or actually by the picture of you working with your laptop and Emma right there on the chest. So, yeah.
It's a very common scene in my home.
Awesome. Okay, well, Paul, thanks so much for making the time to join us today on Talk Animals. We've been speaking with Paul Shapiro, Vice President, Farm Animal Protection, the Humane Society of the United States. The Humane Society's website is Humane Society. Society.org. They're on Facebook, and Paul is on Twitter. Thanks again, Paul.
Thank you, Duncan. Have a great day, my friend.
All right, you too. All right, in just a few minutes, we'll speak with Glenn Hatchell, whom, of course, we enjoy every Thursday as a host of That Day's Morning Show. But we won't be discussing music. We'll be talking dogs, specifically the dog playgroups Glenn conducts at the Humane Society of Tampa Bay. We'll chat with him in just a moment here. Right now, though, let's step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner. We haven't heard one of our fixtures, Brian Regan, in quite a while. So let's dip into the Brian Regan vault with a piece called Flipper and Gentle Ben on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
I watched a lot of Flipper growing up. Flipper, he was something. Always saving people. Every show, he'd go save some more. I save some people! For that, they would throw him a dead fish. Hey, thanks. Thanks for saving people. He was always doing that backwards dance, three quarters out of the water. Man, that was cool. Imagine if you could do that. That'd impress some people at the public pool, you know? Just go, hey, how y'all doing? You know? Just skip across the top of the pool without getting your bathing suit wet and hop up on the other side. Hey, what's happening? And just grab a little towel, wipe off your feet. Yeah, it's a little colder than I thought. Wow, who's that guy? I thought, to be fair, they should have also had a bad dolphin, you know? Zipper! Big scar across his head. I'm moving safety buoys around. Deal with that, Flipper. Out chewing tobacco. Ah, Zipper's surly. He is uncaring. How about that show, Gentle Ben? Do you remember that show? About a big friendly bear. There's a good thing to teach kids. Hey, bears are friendly. Go up and let them give you a big hug. Put some honey on your face. Let them lick it off. Bears love kids with honey on their heads. They love honeyhead kids. Hey, Gentle Ben, where's Bobby? Bobby. Ben's wearing Bobby's hat. I don't know where he is. Picking his teeth. I think he scampered off that way.
All right, that was Brian Regan with a piece called Flipper and Gentle Ben, taken from his album simply entitled Live. Okay, let's welcome Glenn Hatchell back to Talking Animals. Good morning, Glenn.
Good morning, Duncan. Good to be on with you.
Likewise, and great to hear dogs in the background. What, I don't think there could be a more fitting sort of soundscape for our chat here. So,
there's a beagle mix right in the other yard who's talking up a storm at the moment.
Well, we've got the extended dance beagle mix, I guess, then. But so Glenn, last week, I think, as you know, I mentioned that your Pick Your Pooch playgroup. Maybe you could just first briefly describe what that playgroup is and what its intention is, and then we'll kind of fan out to the other kind of playgroups that you oversee.
Sure. Well, what we do here at the Humane Society of Tampa Bay every morning is we get all of the dogs that are here available for adoption out into the play yards, basically playing with each other. It's like a big dog park. We mix dogs based on their energy level, their play styles, and that way we're able to learn a lot about the dogs. And with a lot of dogs, they come in here, they're fearful, they maybe have not been around other dogs, and we can put them into the groups together, let them play. We learn a lot more about the dogs, which make them more which gives us more information for adopters when they want to adopt the dog. So our idea last week was, since we've got a number of great dogs right now at the Humane Society, we decided to do an afternoon play group to have people come up, watch the dogs out playing together, and be able to pick their new best friend from play groups.
And so, Glenn, is based on what you're saying about last week's thing, is it unusual then that people come and watch the dogs in the playgroups that you kind of run over there?
Yes, we do it in the morning, and we're usually done with playgroups before the shelters open for adoption.
So okay,
it's pretty rare for the public to be able to watch us do playgroups.
Okay, because I mean, I certainly you've already mentioned some of the cool virtues for the dogs. I mean, we'll get into a couple more, but yeah, it does seem like periodically it'd be great to be able to come and watch your potential new family member, interact and play. But it sounds like, so they kind of just tend to be in the morning just because that makes the most sense just for the schedule of the shelter?
Correct. And when the adopters come, where we do the playgroups isn't an area that the public typically would have access to. So
I see.
There's some logistic things like that.
I gotcha.
That. But we're looking at it because it really does make a lot of sense for people to be able to see the dogs in that interaction versus just being in a run and then sitting in a little room and meeting them along, one-on-one situation.
Yeah,
it just seems really see.
Yeah, it just seems like a kind of more high octane version of like, is this guy or gal shy? Are they friendly? Are they aggressive? And so if there's maybe one other kennel mate, that's great. But yeah, it just seems like it'd be fun to and helpful probably to see them interact with a group. And so what's the optimal number of dogs in these playgroups?
It really depends on the play styles and the energy level of the dogs. I think this morning I probably had at one point in time 10 or 11 dogs out at one time together playing.
Wow.
So it really depends on the play style. Some days I choose to keep it around 5 or 6, but they still get such an intense experience at 5 or 6 because, I mean, we're talking 25, 30 minutes of constant interaction with another dog, with playing, these kind of things. And
yeah,
not only is it good for them mentally because they get so many brain cells that get fired because of this intense social interaction,
sure,
but also a lot of physical expulsion because they are running and going crazy for about a half an hour in time. And what's great is when the public comes in to see the adoptions or to see the dogs, they come in and the dogs are just absolutely, asleep in their kennels practically. Because
wow,
they're so worn out from the
morning. Right.
So that's one of the great things about it.
Yeah, they've had a great great workout. So, Glenn, so then I take it then you know all the dogs and their sort of personalities and backgrounds when you're assembling these play groups to get to...
I either know the dogs or I learn about them quickly.
Okay,
As far as what they can do. But in a lot of cases, these are dogs that came transferred to us from either Hillsborough County Animal Services or perhaps Pasco County,
right,
Alabama, Georgia, Tennessee, Mississippi.
Yeah.
So in a lot of cases, these dogs come in and I have no idea about the background. I'm just dealing with what's in front of me
at
that very moment.
Right.
So it's all about reading energy and body language.
Yeah. Well, I see maybe a new reality show like Canine Matchmaker, Playgroup Matchmaker, something. I don't know. We need a better title, but we'll get there. But
I like that.
Okay. So I think it's kind of applied, and I might have touched on this last week, but. What are the main virtues of having a playgroup as opposed to shelters or other areas that, for one reason or another, don't have the resources, aren't lucky enough to have somebody like you conduct those playgroups? What are the pluses to this?
Well, I think the biggest plus is that you never know how long a dog's going to be at the shelter, and this gives them the ability to have a really a great mental and physical outlet for them, because you figure in most cases these dogs are sitting in a run for 23, maybe 22 hours a day. So this is their one chance to get out and truly be a dog. And I think from a dog's perspective, that's the biggest thing, to see these guys running around with these happy looks on their face, tails wagging, jumping in the pools, playing with each other.
Yeah.
It's the best therapy possible.
Yeah. So it's fun. It's exercise. It fires those brain cells, as you mentioned earlier. And also, I would think, again, we might even talk about this a year or so ago when we had a little chat about this, but it might be very hard to quantify. But I got to believe this totally ups the odds of those dogs being adopted or adopted sooner than, again, if they just didn't have a play group.
It does, because it helps balance the dog. Any dog that's balanced, is going to know how, when they're in different situations, how to handle themselves, what to do. And this gives the dogs the opportunity to be in some situations that they may have never even been in their lives before.
Right.
And again, it comes back to where we're able to provide potential adopters with more information about the individual dog. So
sure.
If somebody says, you know, I'm a runner and I want a dog that could go 5 miles a day with me, well, you know, probably old Sadie is not going to be the one for that person to adopt.
Right. But this guy over here, this revved up guy over here, is ready to join you on your runs. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Well, cool, Glenn. So, what can you let us know about either information about, you know, I don't know if you already know when the next playgroup that people could come witness, or just generally how people would, you know, find out more about the dogs that are available, and just any information you want to provide about yourself and sort of your work as a trainer, et cetera, as we wrap up here.
Well, there's a couple of things. The best information is go to humanesocietytampa.org, and there's information out there, video blogs of some of the playgroups we've done here. And next time we do a Pick Your Pooch from playgroups, obviously that'll be the where we'll put, you know, where we'll really do a lot of the publicizing.
Sure.
But the other thing from a training aspect is we've also started to do dog training classes here at the Humane Society. So if anybody's got some dogs that are interested in basic obedience, those are available here at the Humane Society as well. So humanesocietytampa.org.
Great. All right, Glenn, anything you want to give us about how to reach you or find out anything about your do, or do you want to keep those separate for now?
Well, if, for information and stuff that we do separately, you can search. Actually, the easiest thing is to search for me online. Cause the
okay.
Or go to, yep, because we... for me online. It's the
okay.
Way to do it.
So, and for people not familiar, it's Glenn Hatchell, H-A-T-C-H-E-L-L, and of course, in a whole different guise. You can hear him tomorrow morning right here on WMNF from 6 to 9 a.m. as the host of the morning show. So, Glenn, thanks so much for joining us, and again, all the great work on behalf of all our dog friends.
Thank you, Duncan.
All right, take care. All right, so we're going to have a very abbreviated animal news and announcements segment here, incredibly abbreviated, but in just a moment or two, we're going to play Name That Animal Tune. The winner will win a copy of Once Upon a Flock, Life with My Soulful Chickens, the new book by last week's guest, Lauren Scheuer. And so just quickly want to mention a couple things. One that just sort of blew my mind, just when you think you've heard all the sort of grim, awful things. This comes from the Miami area. There is this thing that at least I hadn't heard about before called trunking. So people that are, so it's not enough, I guess, to do dog fighting. They put two dogs in the trunk of a car, lock it up, and then drive around, put the music on very, very loud so no one can hear what's going on. And then apparently after 10 or 15 minutes, they stop. And the, you know, unfortunately, the dead dog they throw out and the winner keeps going. I mean, ugh, okay. So now here's something weird I've heard about. First, I have to acknowledge I saw this on a blog post a couple weeks ago by Mindy Lasley, who's an attorney locally, and but separately writes a blog about animal laws and stuff. So anyways, there's this joint that you may be familiar with called Taco Fusion that on its menu offers, among other things, lion meat, venison, snapping turtle, shark meat, etc. Just mentioning. And, all right, well, let's do quickly our Name That Animal Tune before we have to kind of sign off. So, if you can name this animal tune, I'll give you a clue. It's related to the book, and it was recorded Monday. Meanwhile, this is the end of Talking Animals for this week. I'll be back next Wednesday again. Ian Hallett, the Hillsborough County Director of Animal Services, will be in studio, and we'll talk and we'll take some questions and talk about the Be the Way Home plan and many other things. Hope you'll join us for that. And want to wish all the moms out there a happy Mother's Day. And hopefully we'll see you at Tropical Heat Wave Friday and Saturday night. All your information at WMNF.org. And if you do know who this is or what animal song this is, you can call it in and we'll take it off the air. It's Talking Animals. It's WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Wachee, and Beyond Time for the NPR News. Thanks for listening. Take care. See you at Heatwave.